Welcome to the return of Real GM Radio. I'm Daniel LaRue, your host. So happy to have you with us for this episode. I wanted to do a two-part playoff preview, and this is part one with Seth Partnow of the Nylon Calculus, Fancy Stats, Washington Post, Hardwood Proxies and Basketball Network, B-Ball Breakdown, and he also hosts his own podcast, the Make or Miss Podcast. Love talking to him, love having him on. His insight was great. And one of the things that I wanted to do with this is that it is timestamped, so it should be in the iTunes description. It will definitely be on Real GM's website. So I hope you listen to everything. I think it's worth it to listen to everything. But if you want specific pieces, especially if you want them first, because this is coming out on Friday and the playoffs start on Saturday, you can do that. That's one way to listen to this. But I honestly feel like it's worth it to listen to everything. I hope you enjoy it. I love talking to Seth. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me back.
It's exciting because now we actually know who's going to play each other. And before we really get into the nitty gritty, I was wondering what your kind of larger takeaways with how things actually settled were.
I think it kind of broke. I guess it just the way it was always going to. It broke pretty well for the Warriors of the teams that they were going to have to play in the second round of kind of the quote threatening teams. I think would have been like Houston, San Antonio, the Clippers, and Memphis. And I think that Memphis just end of the year so banged up that they are maybe the least threatening team, and that's the most likely second round opponent for the Warriors. So kind of one of the big reasons why Golden State might not be, you know, a betting favorite to win the title is over Cleveland is Cleveland has an easier road to the finals, and I think that maybe changed a little bit with how it broke down, you know. Yeah. on the last couple of days,
because they got the Bulls also, and the Hawks now got an easy road, so it kind of worked out for the first seeds, which I have to like a little bit, just because I've always wanted a system that was more forgiving or more favorable for the one seeds.
Yeah, and actually you wrote something about that today, and I very much like the idea of the opponent draft.
Yeah, I mean, to walk people through it, what I've said, and actually it was funny when I was digging it out, the piece that I wrote on it was originally from 2011, and the idea is that you do top 16, 1 to 16, and the top 8 teams and the bottom 8 teams are separate in a sense, and the top 8 teams can choose, starting with the best team, from the teams in the bottom 8, and for me, it's not only a better reward for the top teams, which I think is a huge flaw in the current system, but also it leads to just ridiculous animosity, because anything that, with the way players operate, that calls out kind of their talent, that calls out their manhood, I think would be really exciting.
You know, both the fairness aspect and the drama aspect of it would be incredible. Just like absolutely, I'm all for stuff like that. If the All-Star game, like if you wanted to, you know, ramp up the intensity of the All-Star game, do the NHL thing where it's like captains and you pick teams, and then, oh really, I'm the last pick in the All-Star game. Well, let's see about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd like that there too. I also think that it would be fun to do some sort of 3-on-3 or 2-on-2 tournament beforehand, which could also lead to more animosity, because then you have the guys who played against each other like 2 days before, and they just hold those grudges for years. Because basketball players really do that. I think people sometimes lose sight of that, but basketball players, not in particular, but just generally, are very, very, very competitive human beings.
And there's, you know, the stuff where the kind of the simmering tensions that were always there between like Ray Allen and Kobe Bryant, and it's the kind of thing, like, never read a great explanation about how it started, but they always hated each other because they always hated each other. And so then when they played against each other, it just had a little bit of an extra edge to it. And that certainly added something to like those last kind of Celtics Lakers finals, just the personal disdain for which they felt for each other.
Speaking of personal disdain, I'm a little bit disappointed that we're seeing the Celtics against LeBron, but none of the old Celtics are on that team, because I don't know if these current guys have any of that animosity, but that was so much fun, even when the former Celtics ended up facing against LeBron.
I haven't seen anything come out about it today. When that series was set, I half jokingly said I expected Evan Turner to make a Celtics in six kind of prediction, but that hasn't unfortunately come to pass yet.
Why are we going to have a playoffs without Brandon Jennings? I mean, that's just disappointing.
Because he signed with the Pistons.
Yeah. and another playoffs without Deion Waiters, but that's also not surprising.
In fact, some might say that there's a causal relationship there.
Nah, I mean, they had the Cleveland had the best backcourt in the league, and they made the playoffs.
Well, they might. Well, I mean, given how J.R. Smith has played since that trade, that is not quite the ridiculous statement it was when it was originally made, but I don't think that's what was meant by it at the time.
So we'll move on to the Western Conference. We'll start there. I think it's more fun to start with the headliners. And the big series, again, going with the headliners, I'm disappointed on a personal level that we're seeing it in the first round, but Clippers-Spurs is going to be magnificent.
It is. I go back and forth. I'm worried that I'm overreacting to kind of the eye test kind of stuff that, you know, everyone sees with the Clippers. And at the same time, it's like I just feel like they're not nearly as good as their kind of record and some of their point differential stuff indicates. So I'm not sure whether to, you know, believe, you know, the metrics or my lying eyes on this one. And the Spurs, you know, the Spurs since Kawhi has come back have been, you know, on the level with the Warriors and the Cavs over that time period. So my instant reaction is that the Spurs are going to win the series. I don't want to say handily, but with a modicum of difficulty.
Yeah, I do think that a limitation or being without Thiago Splitter for a stretch makes it a little bit closer, because I agree with you that on the aggregate, but I think that Splitter is a very important guy with how the Spurs have defended Blake Griffin over the last few years.
I mean, that certainly could be, although at the same time, especially as Griffin has kind of gone more out to the perimeter, it's not like putting Kawhi on him is something that wouldn't work. And then, you know, I don't think Blake has any chance of guarding Kawhi at the other end kind of thing.
That's a good point. It would be fun to see the Spurs play some four out with the guys they have. And yeah, and you're right that the Clippers also don't have a true swingman dominant guy. I mean, Redick's obviously a very good player, but he's not that Kevin Durant style guy who's just going to drill it. He's more of a guy. I think he's more of a guy that Danny Green can guard. If you're not going to put Danny Green on Chris Paul.
There's all kinds of stuff you can do. I mean, I would expect Green and Leonard to guard Paul a lot. And you can, you know, maybe have Tony Parker spend some time guarding Redick, but also, you know, when Corey Joseph is in the game, have him do that. Or Patty Mills and guys who are just going to, you know, run through some screens and, you know, you can make life difficult for him, knowing that the more important thing is to contain and, most importantly, thinking about a series, just kind of wear Chris Paul down based on just the amount of stuff he's going to have to do in this series.
So do you have a guess? I mean, obviously the number of games isn't important, but you were talking about, you know, someone in the handily range. Like, are you thinking six?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the way that's the easy way with the way home court breaks down, even though for all the talk about the Clippers kind of indifferent home court, I'm not sure the Spurs are a team that who travels, you know, their crowd at least travels that well. But at the same time, I don't know how much this particular Spurs team really cares about a road environment.
That's true.
And you know, there's been much has been said about how home court advantage just hasn't meant much this season.
Mm-hmm. And the winner of that series faces the winner of a series that I honestly hadn't seriously considered the dynamics of, both on a personal level and just on a basketball level, of Rockets-Mavericks. I'm a little bit excited about it.
I kind of am too. I mean, the Rockets are not quite the team they've been all year. I think no Motiejunas, no Beverly. Those are not big names, but those are, you know, a little bit of a difference there. I mean, I'll put it this way. I like Rondo's chances of kind of getting himself going a little bit better against, like, Jason Terry than I do against Pat Beverly, you know?
That's not a very high bar, but yeah, I agree with you. And also, Rick Carlisle's a really good coach. I think almost everybody agrees with that. And while I think McHale is doing a better job now than he had done in the past, I think that there's a distinct coaching advantage there. And when you're dealing in a series where there are a lot of potential adjustments for both teams, considering the way they've handled injuries and handled personnel changes over the last, you know, year or two, I think that there could be some space for Carlisle to either extend this series or even potentially swing it.
I think that it, not necessarily the mismatch between the coaches isn't where I'd go with it. Just the fact that I think you have more of an opportunity to do things against Houston just because offensively they are, I mean, for lack of a better term, kind of gimmicky with the kind of the extreme Morey ball style they play. And that's the kind of thing where there's some evidence of this over the last couple of years, but you know, it's, they've played two playoff series and who knows. So, but that, you know, the fact that, you know, when you have time to prepare for it, that kind of, and this is something that will probably come, I'll come back to a fair amount, is kind of how, when you have time to prepare for things that may catch you by surprise, you know, on a Tuesday in the regular season, you can actually do some things against them, and kind of the extreme, we're only shooting threes and getting to the rim kind of thing is, you know, knowing those things about what the offense is doing gives you some opportunities to kind of plan for those things. And then it's like, does Houston get away from what they've been doing? Does that mean, you know, get Terrence Jones working at the mid-range more? That's probably advantage Dallas if that starts to happen, right?
Yeah, it would be. And the other thing that's compelling for me with this series is how Carlisle and the Mavericks choose to defend James Harden. Obviously, he's a phenomenal player, MVP candidate. And Al-Farouq Aminu is definitely an option, but I don't really know. I mean, I don't think you're going to want to put Monte Ellis on him very much.
No. You know who they miss? Who they're going to miss is just Jay Crowder.
Yeah. You mean future All-Star Jay Crowder?
Yeah, future All-Star LeBron stopper. And yes. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that for all that we just kind of said about kind of the sort of the matchup advantages that, you know, might make the series closer than it appears, Dallas just hasn't been that good. You know, they probably weren't as good as the way they started the year. And then they just have been really just not very good since the Rondo trade. And some of that is Rondo's own play. Some of that is the loss of Brendan Wright. And some of it is just kind of natural regression, I think, from an unsustainably hot start. But, you know, all right, Houston might be vulnerable, but is Dallas well equipped to deal with that? And what, by the way, what's the status of Chandler Parsons right now? Yeah, and that's, I mean, and you know, if he's not, you know, if he's not 100%, and you know, with Ariza, Houston has a guy who can deal with him a little, even if he's healthy. And if he's not healthy, then spend some time with Ariza on Ellis, and that just makes it even harder for Dallas. So, yeah, there might be some matchup things that make it easier for Dallas, but the gap was probably big enough that I don't necessarily think it matters.
So Carlisle is saying that it is promising but not definite that Parsons will play in game one. So,
okay.
And I mean, yeah, when you're thinking also about the fact that they're replacing him with Richard Jefferson, probably, I mean, among other guys, considering Richard Jefferson seemed done 2 years ago, and that's being polite to Richard Jefferson.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, I mean, that's a challenge with Dallas, but I mean, I've always thought that Al-Farouq Aminu is the guy who gets some of those minutes, but they'll do a series of different things. But yeah, it's a fun series because both teams do things that the other team isn't particularly great at stopping, but I also think that the guy who might be this huge swing point in that series is Tyson Chandler.
Interesting.
Because his role is to stop penetration in that sense and to be a rim protector. And if he can do that against Houston, I don't think it'll change what they do, but I think it could make them less effective.
Though, I mean, especially against Houston is one of the teams where, you know, if they're kind of going spread pick and roll and then he's stepping up to stop penetration, then kind of who's picking up Dwight on the back line kind of thing. And with Harden and Josh Smith, who's been, you know, pretty good for Houston, they have guys who are able to kind of make those plays to, you know, kind of similar to the plays the Blake Griffin makes for the Clippers to get the ball to DeAndre, just kind of finding a finisher along the baseline. And so while Tyson's, you know, very good at, you know, kind of splitting the difference there, it still puts him in a more difficult spot than he might be against a team that didn't have kind of that backline finisher.
That's definitely true. Anything else on this series?
No, it's a fascinating series, and it's one I'm definitely going back and forth on. And, you know, kind of like you, I find myself talking myself into the Mavs and then remembering, like, wait, I think I'm counting on, like, you know, Dirk from 2013 or something, or, you know, a more recent Dirk than the one we have now. And, you know, he's not the same guy, even though he kind of physically looks the same. And that's kind of, you look up and down their team, and that's kind of where it is.
Yeah. I was thinking about just how that all worked out, and then I was thinking about the next series, which is Memphis and Portland. Things worked out really well for the Grizzlies, considering their current health status, that they should be able to get right against a team that's just been decimated by injury.
Yeah, Portland's season ended when Wes Matthews went down. I mean, it's, you know, they weren't a deep team to begin with, and Aaron Aflalo has been secretly pretty terrible since they acquired him, actually. I thought that was a decent trade for Portland to make, but Aflalo getting, you know, the backup minutes versus becoming a starter is, you know, a decent drop-off. And then for as you know, reasonable as CJ McCollum has been, that's just another further drop-off still. And while, you know, Memphis isn't necessarily a team with the wing scoring to take total advantage of that, it's still, you just wonder if how Portland's going to get enough points against Memphis.
Yeah, especially if their bigs get in foul trouble, because that's something that Memphis can do. And
yeah,
that would make it a lot harder for Portland, because then they'd basically be a Damian Lillard team. And while Dame is great, he's not that guy.
And, you know, also, I mean, I saw someone make this point on Twitter. Is there another team that's going to hit Aldridge on his accidentally on purpose? Like, okay, they're gonna go for strips, like, just all the time. And it's not going to be a dirty play. But, you know, it's a guy with a hurt thumb who's got the ball, go after the ball. And his thumb is going to get hit sometimes. And so that's, you know, you maybe worry about that a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. And also, why part of the reason it's good fortune for Memphis is that it should give them the time to get Mike Conley back for a potential series after that, which is very important, because Memphis, like, at full strength is going to be a dangerous team, but Memphis, anything less than full strength, is going to have a lot of trouble with any of the top teams in the West.
Yeah, and kind of Memphis, the Jeff Green infected Memphis, isn't quite the... Yeah.
It's so disappointing to me. Well, the Jeff Green thing is the Jeff Green thing, but also that Courtney Lee in the last month or so has just not been that guy either, because the hope was that one of the two of them would work out, because Tony Allen has his huge benefits to him. And if they had a fifth guy, it would just totally change the complexion of their team. The fifth guy is not Jeff Green.
Yeah, just they need the one wing scorer, and somehow they still, for, you know, ever since the Rudy Gay trade, or maybe even a little before. So basically, since Rudy Gay injured his shoulder the first time, I think they kind of just have, and whatever happened with OJ Mayo, they just haven't had a consistent, you know, wing threat. And maybe you wish they had the version of Quincy Pondexter that New Orleans has. Even that would be, you know, just okay. You know, we have all this other stuff going around. Just stand there and hit open shots. And they don't even have that, really.
Imagine if they had Korver. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay, it's 29 teams. Oh, darn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I think that's... Are you thinking more in the, 4-5 range for that series, or more 5-6?
I don't know. It could be a longer series, just because it's going to be a grind for Memphis as much as it is. You know, they're not necessarily they're a team that's going to win on points, not by knockout.
Mm-hmm.
If I can make a boxing analogy, I guess that you know, it could be a short series. I mean, if Portland has three games where they just don't make any outside shots, then it might be a sweep. Yeah. Because they're going to be so dependent on making threes, and if that doesn't happen, then it could get ugly fast. But you got to figure they'll have at least a game or two, especially in Portland, where those shots go down, and so maybe it goes 5 or 6.
Yeah, I think we're pretty clean on this one. Moving on to the Warriors and the Pelicans, it makes me feel strange, because I'm super happy for the Pelicans that they got in, and I think it'll be a nice step for Anthony Davis in particular, but most of their guys don't have a much playoff experience, but I feel like they're just going to get slaughtered.
Yeah, just, you know, you try to find things where well, maybe, there's, what's one of the big weaknesses of the Warriors is a not great defensive rebounding team, and you know, Tyreek Evans gets to the bucket, and, you know, kind of an interesting quirk for him is, you know, his missed shots are amongst the most offensive rebounded of any team. He was, I think, the most last year, and I haven't looked as of the end of this season, but up until about a month ago, he was again the highest percentage.
But then you see of his misses are rebounded by teammates. But then the guys who are good at offensive rebounding for New Orleans are guys who can't finish when they get the offensive rebound. So it's like if you look at like Ashik and Ajinsa, and Davis is very good on putbacks also. But I mean, so but of the other two guys who get a lot of their offensive rebounds are really bad at, you know, putting the ball back up and scoring. It's sort of good news, bad news there. And just there's, I kind of feel like that Golden State is just with matchups and movement and stuff, just going to tie anything New Orleans tries to do in on defense in knots. Were we having this discussion, or was I having it with someone else about, you know, I'd be very tempted anytime Ashik was on the floor just to give him nobody to guard, go super small and you know, and if they're going to, if Omer Ashik is going to, or is going to beat you with his offense, then if he's going to beat you scoring over Draymond Green or something like that, you live with that.
But, are when you're saying putting no one on him, do you mean David Lee?
No, I think David Lee is, no, I mean, I think like playing like Draymond at the five.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that would be really fun going five out and just going real, real different there. And also that negates some of what Anthony Davis does so well.
Yeah, and so, you know, if it's just, if they're going to play like Davis and Anderson, then maybe you go slightly more conventional and you know, have Bogut kind of do dirty Andrew Bogut things on Anthony Davis. And also, I mean, it just, you know, Golden State is going to score a billion points, so it whatever else happens probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm thinking that it'll end up being five just because I think they'll pull out one game at home and just be, you know, they'll have they've had some really good games. I mean, they were dominating the Spurs early in that game for reasons that I'm not completely clear on because I actually missed the first half of that game. But I think that they'll put it together for one game and that'll be nice and I'll be really happy for them and then it'll be over.
They got so they were so there for the taking in the fourth quarter of that game.
Oh yeah,
and the Spurs just didn't really execute very well. But they were so tight in the fourth quarter, in the early fourth quarter of that game. It's like, you know, that you could almost see like their guards like take out a little like pump needle and try to literally take the air out of the ball on every possession and stare at the clock. That thing isn't moving fast enough. Are we done yet?
They hope to go back to a 35-second shot clock for the second half.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something that I worry actually about a little bit with this Pelicans team is that they played with a lead in a way that's very different than when the Warriors actually played with their starters with a lead, which is just, you know, going for it as long as you can and then, you know, eventually, you know, taking your foot off the gas pedal. They did a lot of playing not to lose.
Yeah, but taking your foot off the gas pedal by putting Brandon Rush in the game, not by Steph Curry holding the ball at half court.
Yeah, exactly. Are you talking about a conspiracy theory to boost up Stephen Curry's plus minus stats by putting in the backups and allowing them to get annihilated?
I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's a statistical fact and artifact that some of like that stuff looks a little bit better than it maybe should because of, you know, terrible fourth quarter lineups.
Yeah.
I mean, I was looking at this the other day. Is like, you know, the Warriors through three quarters with Curry off the court are still a 50-win team. You know, they play at a 50-win level, and then the fourth quarter they're just awful with him off the court. But that's because with him off the court in the fourth quarter, the lineups are like,
yeah, it's not representative.
Know, it's like Justin Holiday and Leandro Barbosa and Mo Spates anchoring the lineup and. You know, it's these aren't real lineups, and they're points in games where they're, you know, they're up 20, and who cares?
Yeah, and the other team is gunning a lot more for it than the Warriors guys are because those Warriors guys already have their role and everything else.
So yeah.
Would you rather go to the East or do a little bit on how you think the later rounds could go? We don't need to go into so much depth because we don't even know who's going to be facing each other. But which way makes more sense to you?
You know, I think that, and we talked about a little bit that I think that the Warriors, assuming it's Memphis, I think that, you know, unless some things change and we get, you know, two solid weeks of good Jeff Green, for example, and Mike Conley is healthy enough to battle credibly against Steph Curry, I think that that's a fairly straightforward series for Golden State. And then the other side, I mean, Houston, San Antonio's the most likely, right?
Yeah, I think I would probably favor the Spurs-Clippers winner over the Rockets, despite not having home court, regardless of who gets it.
I think so, too. I mean, I think that you know, if we're talking about, you know, Houston with Beverly, and he's making, Beverly's making noises about trying to get back on the court, isn't he?
I think so. But yeah, it's hard to imagine him being even close to 100%. But
yeah,
being and below 100% could still be very useful for the Rockets.
Yeah, but you know, without him and Mota Yunus, you know, that's one of the things is he's turned into a decent enough player, but also just the fact that he's just such a different look for them than their other big guys is which, you know, especially against San Antonio, being able to kind of do multiple different things is kind of important, because if you're, again, we talked about it a little before, if Houston's doing the same old thing over and over again, I think Pop especially is going to have something for them.
Absolutely. You know? Do you think that the Spurs are the toughest conceptual matchup for the Warriors of any team in the league in a 7-game series?
I mean, conceptual, I don't know. I mean, LeBron is a pretty tough conceptual matchup for anybody. You know, with all due respect to kind of Draymond, they don't have necessarily ideal, you know, personnel to guard him, though who does? I mean, between the two of them, sure. We're getting ahead of ourselves, but the Cleveland matchup is interesting because, you know, someone who's going to come right back at Curry and maybe, you know, test the Steph Curry elite defender theory a little bit Kyrie is not going to be afraid of going right at Curry on the offensive end as well. But sure, I mean, San Antonio is you know, the in a, especially in a playoff series, is the toughest conceptual problem for basically every team, just because, I mean, their depth and the number of different ways in which they can, you know, decide to play that can present a number of different challenges.
Do you think that the difficulty of the Spurs road to get to the conference finals gives a little bit of a boost to the Warriors in terms of likelihood of making the NBA finals, even if you're more dubious of the Warriors in that particular matchup?
I mean, sure. I mean, dodging the Spurs is, you know, the less likelihood they have of facing the Spurs in the conference finals, the better their likelihood of making the finals. I mean, that seems fairly straightforward, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was just thinking about how hilarious it would be this year, considering the way that the NBA does seeding. If the conferences automatically reseeded, we probably would have gotten Warriors Spurs in the second round because they ended up at the six. That's why you let them choose their opponents.
So if they, you think if they reseeded, it would have been so it would have been. Yeah, no, they would have been probably the fourth team, because assuming that Houston beats Dallas, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't expect Dallas to win that series. Then the Warriors would be sweating bullets throughout that. But yeah, that's
come on, Dallas is, I think, what
they rooted for Memphis last night. I'm guessing. I wasn't in the locker room, but I'm assuming they were very happy with the result. But we'll move on to the East, and I think we can talk about it, of course. But I think that the first round series, other than Raptors Wizards, are pretty cut and dry.
Yeah, the Celtics don't have enough to do anything against Cleveland, all due respect to, you know, what's been a nice second half run. It's just not nearly enough talent there to, you know, a team that's, since LeBron came back from the sabbatical, they've been the best team in the league right there with the Warriors, basically, once they've had a full team that kind of makes sense, as opposed to kind of the mismatched parts they had up until January.
Deion Waiters, the one-man island of misfit toys.
Well, it wasn't just that. It was also, you know, Marion at shooting guard and you know, no rim protection even with Vergeau healthy and you know. And now
even, an even more poorly utilized Kevin Love.
Yeah, I can go as long as you want on the whole Kevin Love. No, I think that, you know, it's you know, what's best for Kevin Love versus what's best for Kevin Love's stats versus what's best for the Cavs are very different things. I think that especially if his mobility is limited, and it's, I think, fairly clear that it is, the way he's being used is about how he should be used.
Random aside, if the Warriors had done the rumored but rejected by the Warriors Klay Thompson for Kevin Love as the principal's deal, how do you think the Warriors would look this year?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, historical offense is still right there. Their defense probably isn't. They're probably not as good, just because their offense might be a little bit better, but their defense than it has been. But their defense would be much worse.
Yeah, and you lose some of what Draymond brings, because if he's playing more of the three. But then I was thinking about the idea of how much amazingness you would have put in for stretches playing Draymond and Love at the 4-5 and just going demonic five out.
No, they were. I mean, they would have scored all the points.
All the points.
But you know, especially given Klay Thompson's improvement offensively, which has been real and substantial, and on top of just being, you know, the everyone on the roster being utilized better. Who saw that coming? Aside from everyone, as I disrespect the caterpillar, what they would maybe gain in offense is just massively offset by what they would lose. You know, basically, you know, taking our one arguable defensive player of the year candidate and putting him into a different spot where he's probably less effective, and you know, losing and just taking another kind of all defense first, second team level guy. I think if I had a ballot, I might vote for Thompson first team all defense.
Wow.
I'm a huge fan of his defense.
Interesting.
So just super impressed by it. But anyway.
Yeah. But moving back to the East, of the three lower seeds, so the Bucks, the Celtics, and the Nets, they're all low chances, but who would you say has the best chance of pulling the first round upset?
Bucks. Yeah.
Yeah. The other two don't really have any chance. It's hard to be lower than almost zero.
Yeah, no, the Nets are making noises, and or kind of people supporting the Nets are making noises, but you know, all right, fine. And even if you want to say Atlanta's not as good as their record and, you know, Cephalosha stuff, they, you know, they've been without Cephalosha for most of the year, and you know, you would talk about a team that is even keel enough by any kind of, you know, reporting, observation, whatever, that the guys in the locker room are going to be professional and not be distracted. It's them. And you know, and they're just so much better than the Nets, who just aren't good. And
plus if the Nets won, the Hawks have the right to swap wins in the series at the end of it, because as a part of the Joe Johnson trade.
That would be amazing. Heads I win, tails you lose.
Yeah. So Raptors, Wizards, I do think... I don't know. I don't think it's going to be fun, but I do think it'll be interesting.
It's Camp Depression.
And it's potentially the only series that goes seven, or that goes that goes 6-7 in even in that range.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think the Bucks and Bulls. First of all, the Bucks and Bulls series it may go seven games, but it'll seem like 14, because I think we're gonna see some games in the 70s in that series.
Ugh.
It's going to be a rock fight.
Thankfully, neither team has Scott Skiles as the coach, because that would just make it more ridiculous.
Yeah.
Not that I dislike Scott Skiles. It's going to be a rock fight. I agree with you. Do you think that... I think the Wizards have a pretty good chance. I like them, and I like the Raptors when they're 100%, but I'm just not totally sold on them right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you like Washington, you kind of go with the best player in the series theory, and I think that, you know, for as good as Kyle Lowry is, I think Wall is probably just a cut above, so that's as the best player in the series. And then it's I don't know, every time I start to think about this series, it's just like I just sink into a dark morass of
do you think either of them has a chance of beating the Hawks? A realistic chance. Let's not do the like any chance, like one out of a thousand, you know, a realistic chance.
You look at the talent on paper and stuff like that, and you can sure, but then you look at how both teams have played, and kind of, you know, you talk about the playoffs being a matchup game, and you know, not to be, you know, coaching expert commentator guy, but do you trust either of those guys to press the right buttons in a series where they're, you know, at a disadvantage to, you know, flip the script?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Both teams are kind of very much less than a sum of their parts as assembled, kind of as they're, you know, playing. There's a lot of kind of wasted motion on both squads, and as compared with the Hawks,
the Wizards.
And by, you know, by contrast, you know, the Hawks is just like the economy of motion, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you're, I mean, you know, I think we've in general underrated the Hawks' talent.
Yeah.
A little bit like we did with the Spurs last year. Like, they have, you know, really good players. I think you know, Millsap and Horford especially are really good. So, you know, I think in that series, Atlanta arguably has the two best players on the floor against either team, and those two guys. So, and then, you know, and you know, you want best player, Korver's kind of a weird, you know, guy to talk about in terms of best player, but in terms of impactful player, I mean,
he's certain his movement and shooting and his passing ability and everything he does also yeah. just makes him a tremendously effective player.
And they not only have it at the top, but they also have substantially more and better depth, which is important as well, because they have depth in ways that they will play them. It's not like, oh, their 8 to 10 guys are really good. Their core rotation guys are also very solid.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a little bit, you know, aside from, you know, maybe Antic, who's not good, but they have, you know, a little bit like the Spurs, they have the gears, they can change gears, you know, they go, you know, kind of a small ball with Mike Scott kind of thing. They can go 2-point guards with Teague and Schroeder, and, you know, playoff Schroeder, I'm excited for.
I was just going to say, I'm excited that in that series, playoff Schroeder gets to face either Kyle Lowry or John Wall, which seems intriguing to me. I would be excited to see how that works out.
Or maybe he gets to face Grievous Vasquez for Ramon Sessions.
Oh. But yeah. So the last second round series is the one that I think we all want to see and also that we expect to see, which is Cavs-Bulls. I think that the Cavs are the heavy frontrunners unless the Bulls get all the way back to their ceiling. If they can reach their ceiling, it gets competitive.
We talk about their ceiling. Do they? I mean, I think we're kind of like we talked about with Dirk, you know, a little bit. We're kind of, you know, hearkening back to days of Bulls past, and especially Bulls defenses past.
That's definitely true. Especially when, well, I was thinking it's also again a distant dream that they're going to play more of Mirotić with Noah and Powell with Taj, and we haven't seen it.
Yeah, and you know, and I don't think we've seen kind of good Noah all year, and whether or not that's, you know, him being a little nicked up or, you know, him being shunted out outside more by playing with Pau. At the same time, you know, you talk about one of the ways that you know, Chicago could, you know, really make that a competitive series, and that's, you know, Pau dominating offensively. So it's you know, it's, if you squint your eyes, you see ways in which the Bulls could do some stuff, but then you realize just what a massive advantage Cleveland's going to have on the perimeter, almost regardless of what else happens. I mean, you know, whether it's this year's Derrick Rose or Aaron Brooks or the ghost of Kirk Heinrich or something, like Kyrie, you got to figure that Kyrie is not going to be slowed down so much in that series, right?
Yeah, and I agree with that.
And they don't necessarily have anyone else they can slide over to cover him either. I mean, Jimmy Butler or whatever, but you know, then who guards LeBron? And it's
on top of Mike Dunleavy, the LeBron stopper.
I thought we already decided that Jay Crowder was the LeBron stopper.
Well, he's going to transfer it like in Freaky Friday to Mike Dunleavy. That is a movie I would totally see.
Okay, my mind just melted.
Yeah, do you think that the Cavs have a better chance of making the finals than the Warriors?
You know, before the seeds were finalized, I would have said yes. Now it seems like it's kind of broken perfectly for to be as difficult as possible for the Cavs and as easy as possible, you know, from where it could have been for the Warriors. So I don't know. I think the Cavs have on the overall scale of things, I think the Warriors are probably a slightly better team, but they also have a somewhat harder route. So how that shakes out, I don't know.
It's a good, yeah, and I think people are underrating the Hawks. You know, as much as I think that the Cavs are a really good team, and I think that people are also underappreciating how well they played since LeBron took his break, that the Hawks are quite a good team, and so I think that they'll get a challenge there, but there isn't a team there that I think is as dangerous as the Spurs, let's say.
Yeah. And if I can, like one of the you know, having watched a ton of the Hawks this year, one of the, you know, the sort of the matchup ways that they, you know, they seem weakest to, you know, I guess a blueprint is kind of the game where their long winning streak got snapped was against New Orleans. And basically, they just got physically dominated by Anthony Davis, but even more than that, Tyreke Evans. And, you know, LeBron is like the super uber great, awesome, actually good version of Tyreke Evans, just in terms of his ability to add skills and decision making on top of, you know, the size and athletic gifts. And then, you know, him and Kyrie. So you have like two of the
top whatever kind of abilities to, you know, deconstruct a defense individually, guys, against a team that's, you know, based more on snuffing out kind of system movement and then and counting on the individual defensive talent to not get broken down that much. Well, all of a sudden they're going to be getting broken down all over the place because of who they're playing against. And I just wonder if that kind of breaks their system a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point, and it's unfortunate in some ways that the worst possible matchup, but a bad matchup for the Hawks is the team that will likely.
No, I think it might be the worst possible matchup for them. I think the Hawks match up better with the Warriors than they do with the Cavs.
I was going to ask you about that. I was thinking of it slightly the other way, but that's also for me whether Cleveland can get to where I think they can go.
Yeah, no, I just think that while Steph is obviously an individually destructive player, it's not the forcefulness with which LeBron and Kyrie do it is the kind of thing which I think Atlanta is not well equipped to deal with. Like they can, you know, on Curry, they can double and help and recover and move, but they just, you know, if you've looked at games where they just have not done well, it's just been that just getting physically overwhelmed to the basket and from especially from the perimeter. And you know, the Warriors don't necessarily have that guy, but the Cavs do. And
I can see the logic in that. I was just realizing that if we get a Cavs Warriors finals, we get two guys who have never coached an NBA game before the season.
Yeah. Though guys, you've obviously taken a very different route to get there.
Absolutely. It's so far ahead, but your quick thoughts on a potential Cavs Warriors finals. We talked about it a little bit before.
I don't know. It's kind of how much do we count the account for, you know, the fact that, you know, that would be LeBron's sixth finals and, you know, right. And the four with the Heat and yeah.
And the six one with finals. The Cavs.
Yeah. And, you know, the first, you know, by massive amounts, the biggest games for everyone aside, unless we're going to count like Draymond in the Final Four, right?
Yeah.
For anybody on the Warriors, and you know how much you think that matters or not matters some, but not totally.
And it's also true that most of the guys on the Cavs haven't had any fringe players have, but yeah, it's crazy. I mean, if that happens, it would be very atypical for a lot of reasons, but not atypical considering the talent involved.
No, but that is a really good point. Is that the only, like, from both teams, the only guy who's going to be getting significant kind of rotation time that's been there, done that at all is LeBron on either team.
Well, Amon Shumpert was on a title contender on the Knicks.
Okay.
That year, the year that J.R. Smith elbowed Jason Terry.
Yeah, they were a title contender until J.R. Smith went J.R. Smith.
I was talking about this with somebody the other day. I don't think that team was a real title contender.
No, you? I don't either. I don't either.
Yeah, they were good. They were good. Yeah, and that was exciting for New York, but I didn't think they were a title contender.
No, they were a team that whose regular season record kind of overstated the strength of their team in kind of the playoff environment, which is, you know, I think that's something that it's just, you know, there are subtle differences between the two games. And it's not just the, you know, when things slow down in the playoffs, though they do. But it's also it's the seeing the same team, you know, six, seven times in a row, and the game is officiated a little bit differently, and you know you're playing against a good team every night instead of, you know, the Lakers every other night, or the, you know, yeah. Oh, this week we've got the Sixers and the Lakers, so we can work on some stuff. You don't have that opportunity.
Yeah, and the way that you see a game is very different in a seven game series because the coaches are looking for those advantages and they're doing everything in that, as opposed to thinking about this game and thinking about the next game, which is going to be against somebody different, probably in a different town.
Yeah, no, and it's just that level of focus that it kind of requires, you know, a little bit of a different tool set. Like
yeah.
you know, like a team like the Hawks. When another part, you know, offensively, one of the things you worry about them going into the playoffs is, you know, their kind of extreme pace and space ball player movement thing. You know, if you've if you played Oklahoma City the night before and now you play the Hawks, is this the same game? Mm-hmm. super ISO pound the ball kind of, and that's overstated a little bit for Oklahoma City, but go with it. versus, you know, the Hawks ball player movement and stuff like that. And, you know, that if you're just, you know, on a random night in the season, that catches you by surprise. And maybe, you know, the first half of the first game, it catches you by surprise to, you know, get velocitated to it in the playoffs. But then, all right, we've seen that. Let's figure out how we can deal with that. Okay, how do we, you know, guard Korver and not leave him? How do we, where is it okay to let Horford do his thing, and where do we have to, you know, what shots do we have to run him off of? Those little things that if it's you know, four games out of 82, you there's some intricacies that you just don't pick up on, or you can't, because, you know, how could you? Versus if you're just focusing all of your energy on it for, you know, 2 weeks. Maybe you can really create some adjustments. And so, you know, maybe the Hawks have wrinkles for that, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And versus, you know, what is your wrinkle for, you know, I am LeBron James, no one can stop me because I am LeBron James. And it's kind of reductive, but, you know, it's also, yeah.
Do you think we'd see a fair amount of Shumpert on Stephen Curry if that series happens?
That's a good question. I don't know whether Shumpert he's as good as his kind of rep defensively. I mean, I think the important thing you need against whoever's guarding Curry is discipline, and I don't know if that's necessarily, you know, Shump's maybe a little bit more of a gambler, go for steals, kind of getting passing lanes kind of thing, and you can't do that guarding Steph, right?
True.
You have to, you know, it's. Maybe the best way to guard him in that hypothetical series is, all right, Kyrie, you're going to have to run through some screens and we'll give you help on every screen, but you just work as hard as you can to stay close to him and make him work and, or alternatively, just double him in every pick and roll and, you know, make Draymond Green and Andrew Bogut score to beat you.
Or alternatively, what I was asked about this on the radio a couple weeks ago, which is funny considering how far away we are from it. And I said, maybe what you do is you focus on stopping everybody else. You do kind of, I said it was what Miami should have done against Dirk when they faced them, which is I didn't trust any of their other guys to really create for themselves if they had a blanket on them, and do that. And then just maybe Curry's going to get 35-40, but you're not going to rely. I think it would stagnate the Warriors offense. And I think it would work. Honestly, I think that's the way to do it with Cleveland's personnel. If you have the Spurs personnel, then you do something very different.
I don't know about that, just because Golden State runs so much stuff where they're kind of bouncing people off Curry a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
And so if you're, you know, all of a sudden you're turning it into, you know, if you're, you know, blanketing Klay Thompson with whoever and not helping off of him, then all of a sudden, anytime like Klay Thompson sets a ball screen for Steph, it's a double screen because it's, you know, Klay's guy and the guy who's guarding him are both in Kyrie's way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just not letting Curry come off that pick cleanly seems to be, and easier said than done, obviously, because he's, you know, he's clever with the ball and, you know, doesn't need that much space to get a shot off and all that stuff. But that would seem to me to be the more fruitful. And it's not ideal because then you're kind of forced to play a little bit of 4-on-3 with a guy who's a good passer with the ball.
Yeah, I also think we'd see LeBron on Curry at the end of games, which would be thrilling. I'm not sure I'd be more excited for any defensive matchup than that, because we've already seen a little bit of Kawhi on Steph and we've seen Danny Green, but LeBron, I mean, that is something that I've always wanted to see. And I mean, I'd love to see Anthony Davis guard a perimeter scorer. That's the other one I've wanted to see for years. We're not going to really get to see that this year, but LeBron on Curry would be amazing.
No, that I think we'll see a little bit of that, and that'll definitely be fun. I mean, I think that, you know, they'll throw in this hypothetical matchup, they'd throw a bunch of different guys at him at various times, and maybe have Kevin Love guard him and see if Curry laughs himself to death. And you know, actually who might spend a little bit of time on him is Tristan Thompson.
Like, wow. That would be fascinating.
No, if they, I mean, you think about that, like switch and
switch. All right,
switch it and, you know, and be ready to have some help along the baseline, and if he you know, if he gets by, you stay with him and make Curry finish in the trees every time. That's one possibility. But it's just, you know, giving him different looks and not letting him get, you know, those easy shots where for him where he's kind of, you know, in a nice rhythm, just coming off the pick and roll on the bounce.
Yeah, that'd be fun. But before I let you go, I wanted to give you the floor to, I'm not a big awards guy, I think you know that, but if there are any guys or roles or whatever that you think, or an award that you think should be out that isn't given, of something that you think is a misconception that you would like to correct, let's make it awards centric.
I think a lot of the discussion of defense is still so questionable because it's so focused on like stopping on an individual matchup, stopping your guy. And I think that 80% of the time your guy doesn't have the ball and you're still doing important things defensively when your guy doesn't have the ball. And it's not as important. Like, you're not, you know, obviously when your guy has the ball, he's the most dangerous, but so much of what makes someone a good defender is what happens when they're not guarding the ball. And that leads to silliness like, well, you know, DeAndre Jordan is great at rotating over and, you know, blocking shots, but there's other things he doesn't do very well. So I don't know. That's why a guy like, you know, Kawhi is just, you know, massively awesome, is not only is he on the ball a great defender, but he's a, you know, great help defender and a great, you know, gamble for steals defender and really good rebounder and just everything that goes into defense. So, you know, I guess maybe I'm stumping for him to be defensive player of the year, even though in my hypothetical ballot, I think I voted for Bogut. Mm-hmm. My hypothetical, I don't actually have a ballot.
We're not, they don't love us.
No,
that's all right.
Yeah, I, you know,
we'll create a third award just for people, yeah, who don't get votes for the media one and who aren't players.
Well, to be honest, like, I don't know if it's the same for you, but getting enough kind of vitriolic feedback from even the hypothetical ballots that I would hate to see what it would look like if what my mail would look like if I had an actual ballot that people could get mad at.
I don't let that stuff bother me too much anymore, but yeah, it definitely does happen. I mean, anytime you make a tangential reference, the one that got me recently was, I wasn't even being critical. I made a passive comment about how, oh, it's funny that the Hawks basically dumped Lou Williams before the end of the year, and I the Hawks had a great year. I love the Hawks, and all these Hawks fans just came after me. Thanks in no small part to Robbie Kalin retweeting it and responding to it. But
yeah,
it was just like, okay, you know, I was, yeah, that's not what I was saying. It was just interesting that there was this guy who is being a substantial positive for another team in the playoff race that was dumped for what ended up not being a whole lot, but that wasn't obviously the plan. The plan was to use the cap space for something more substantive. It just didn't happen.
Well, it's, you know, it could have been worse. He could have been, you know, dumped for the right to pay his part of his salary for the next 5 years and then be a key contributor on another playoff team, but you're still out the salary the next 5 years.
Or they
didn't make the playoffs anyway.
They could have signed Lance Stephenson.
No, you know, all right, I'm going to, you know, that was I think a very reasonable gamble. Like the contract like very reasonable, and it just has worked awfully. But it's, I mean, maybe he comes, you know, if he wasn't healthy to start the year, and maybe he gets a full training camp and things work out, blah, blah, blah. Or he's just an albatross, yeah, and it goes down as one of the worst signings of all time. I think
it has a team option the last year. You're talking, yeah, to somebody who actively stumped for the Warriors to trade David Lee for Lance Stephenson. And I wasn't doing it sarcastically. I was doing it because I thought it would be a good move for the Warriors.
Though I think that the season that George Hill had makes me like Lance Stephenson less.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. George Hill was great this year,
sense.
And he was great this year, and he was like him and Roy. He was alongside Roy Hibbert were kind of the pincushions for Pacers fans last year. And it's like, well, he was obviously, now we can see I always thought he was a pretty good player, and he was, you know, put into kind of a very tertiary role to allow Lance to do some stuff, and now it seems that Hill could have done the Lance things just as well. Apparently,
Kyle Lowry without Rudy Gay, anyone?
Yeah,
it happens.
Yeah,
it happens. But I think the reason I wanted him on the Warriors was because I thought he would be a really intriguing bench player on a team that doesn't. I mean, Sean Livingston does a lot of things well, and I'm a huge fan of Sean Livingston. But I think that he would have brought some something to an offensive unit that stagnates a lot, and his defense would be really nice with those units.
Oh, and again, I think that the stagnation of the Warriors' offense with Curry on the bench is aside, you know, is overblown because it you're counting the trash fourth quarter lineups a little too heavily.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, again, they were a +3.5 or so, per game team through three quarters with Curry on the bench. So it's not like they weren't still pretty good. You know, they were like as good as the Rockets are, basically, with you know the all the Rockets, you know, with Harden, with Curry on the bench. So, you know, the need for that bench punch is maybe a little bit. All right, you're not a 60 some win team with the probable MVP on the bench. Well, no crap.
Yeah, that's a good point. Anything else you want to share with listeners?
Oh man, it's so much playoff previews to do now.
Andrew Bogut wins the Rim Protection Award, correct?
Rudy Gobert.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, Rudy Gobert pulled it out at the end. It was those were the I mean, you know, it's an estimate, so I'm not saying that, you know, one is definitively better than the other or anything like that, but
that is,
you know,
what you're saying. That is only what you're saying.
Yeah, no, in the ironclad rankings of 2014-15 rim protection, Rudy Gobert wins. Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Okay, this is something I got a little bit. I was talking on Twitter I think it was a month ago. I feel like the Jazz could win 45 plus games next year, maybe even 50.
They, you know, they need they need some help in the backcourt.
Yep.
Whether that's, you know, natural development from Dante Exum. I think, you know, with the way that that Gordon Hayward plays, he's not quite on the level. I mean, there's, you know, you talk about, you know, guys who are wings who are basically playing point guard on offense, like, you know, like LeBron and James Harden. In terms of role this year, Hayward basically in the last 2 years, Hayward has basically done that. Whether he's good enough at that to really fulfill that role, and then Exum becomes sort of a 3-and-D point guard almost. But then you still need one more guard, and it's not Trey Burke. Whether it's Alec Burks coming back, or you know, a guy like Elijah Millsap, Bryce Cotton becomes a decent player, or they, you know, they get kind of a combo guard in the draft.
Mario Hezonja.
Where they're going to be picking? I mean, is the guy from Ohio State? I don't know this year's draft well enough to really speculate on specifics. Someone not a Harrison twin, obviously. so yeah, I mean, there's certain though. I mean, I think that there may be set up for, you know, the. They had the feel good, you know, second half of this season. Maybe they're set up for, you know, the wheels fall off season like the Suns sort of had this year.
Yeah, and I was thinking about it also in the context of, we talked about how the West was decimated to a point by injuries this year, but you know they were still really good teams. I feel like at this point, the West next year, if they don't move to a top 16 format, might be the hardest conference to make the playoffs in NBA history.
I don't know. I think there are a couple teams that I think are in the playoffs this year that I think are very likely to take substantial steps back next year.
Dallas.
I think Dallas, Portland. You know, Portland has a ton of guys up for free agency. You know, even if they re-sign Wes Matthews, like, you know, when's he going to be back? How good is he going to be next year? And, you know, it's not like they have a lot of depth behind that. So, I think they're going to look a fair amount different next year anyway, and probably be a fair amount worse. So those are kind of the two teams you look and think are going to take a step back. You know, what is obviously Oklahoma City is going to be less injured next year. So that's one team that's better, and New Orleans will be maybe a year better, but still, I think that, you know, there are teams that will be sliding down to account for Utah maybe, you know, coming up.
Yeah, and from what I recall, you were not the biggest supporter, it's in the same boat as me, with the Brandon Knight trade. And I think the Suns are going to be in a challenging spot next year. They obviously have lots of talent, but if, let's say that it's a 10 deep before them, that's
they have a lot of guys.
They have a lot of guys.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how many, you know, how many above average, you know, rotation, you know, I think Zach Lowe didn't coin this, but he, I think, popularized it last year, was kind of the just a guy. And it feels to me like a lot of the Suns guys are just a guy, you know. Yeah. You know, some of them are you know, good to decent players, but aside from maybe Bledsoe, who's the real, like,
Markieff is good, but Markieff isn't the, like, great player on a great team type of guy. He's more of a good player on a great team.
Yeah. And, you know, they've got some you know, P.J. Tucker is a really good defensive player, but, you know, if P.J. Tucker's your fourth best player, that means P.J. Tucker's your fourth best player, you know what I mean?
I guess the hope is Len.
Maybe Len becomes something, but then, you know, it's...
And it's so great for them that they have that Lakers pick coming in 2016, because they're really going to need that.
Oh, wait.
Oh, I feel bad. Yeah. I give Suns fans crap for that all the time. Well, all the time since it happened. But that move is the move that I loved everything else largely that they've done, because assuming they couldn't get Kevin Love, which I don't think they could have, that they did. And then the Brandon Knight move just to me was a double whammy, because they got a guy who didn't make a ton of sense for them, and they gave up what could have been that game-changing asset.
Yeah, no, I think everything that could have, all the negatives that could have happened from, you know, outperforming expectations last year, and all of a sudden the expectations were jacked up this year, and then this year became just, you know, jacked up start to finish. You know, from, you know, basically from, you know, PJ Tucker's DUI on, like, this has been very much a just a kind of a train wreck of a season for them, really. I mean, I think the Bledsoe contract thing didn't help, and then that probably, you know, in some ways bled into the Goran Dragic's unhappiness, and you know, the Isaiah Thomas move in a vacuum made sense, and, you know, still probably does, but you still probably do that just from an asset standpoint, but it's like all these things, like, collided with each other and made it a substantially lessened team, I guess. And it's so almost they like, you know, last year was two steps forward, this year was one step back.
Yeah. Question to end it on, I had thought about this a couple days ago, but do you think, and there's so many things not that we don't know, do you think that this is Golden State's best chance at winning a title the next couple of years?
You know, that my thought is, if you're not going to spend the money to keep this team together with the new TV deal about to come into place, you shouldn't be owning a team.
So, agreed, wholeheartedly.
So, if something were to occur that, like, say Draymond was not back next year, I think that's I don't want to say criminal because we're talking about basketball here, but that's, you know, that would be a big deal. I think that the core they have, I mean, the one kind of squeaky wheel that they need to worry about is Bogut. And, you know, kind of finding someone who can, I think that, you know, his defense is it's not easily replaceable, especially by, especially when he also taking into account kind of his offensive contributions, which are just more like his screening and passing, but still. But aside from that, like, is there any reason why, like, this core largely can't stay together for another couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like they'll have this group until 2017. The big question is, will the older guys moving down be offset by the younger guys moving up? Because they're not really going to have much in terms of additional assets. You know, they're not going to get much better talent on this team. But the question is, will they improve? And then the other huge question with that is, I think that the Spurs, I don't think it's a very controversial thing to say that the Spurs are likely to be worse next year than they were this year, assuming healthy. Obviously, they could have a better record, but I feel like as their players are aging, it lowers their ceiling. And Cleveland might be better, and the Rockets will probably be better. But I think that this three-year window is very important, but we've seen with teams like the Thunder. I mean, I thought the Thunder had a window too, and they still do, technically.
But I think the natural parallel is that, like, they're not necessarily the same player. I think Harden is I'm going to blaspheme a little here and say that I think that Draymond has actually gotten mildly overrated, if only because I think that, you know, him getting all NBA, like, second, third team mentions is a bridge too far. But it's still a very similar decision point than the Harden trade. And, you know, at the time and in retrospect, like,
that was kind of it didn't shut the window, but it lowered it,
it narrowed it for sure.
Yeah, and with no inside information, I don't think that Golden State's going to do something similar, are they?
No, they aren't. I mean, there was a time that I was worried about it. I actually, before the season, said some things about that. But what happened is Draymond played so well that it made that position untenable. So he forced them to make that impossible to say no is probably
the way to put it. And I think that for even if he was to go out and get like a max contract offer elsewhere, he would be so much better served by staying in Golden State. Absolutely.
And the other component of that, the way that the Warriors would be worse is probably not by losing Draymond. It would be if they had to give up something to get under the tax. And if it's David Lee, that's not the worst thing in the world. They already have Maurice Bates and Festus Ezeli. Yeah. But if, let's say, they're required to give up assets they don't have, and so they go, well, the only thing we can really give up is Andre Iguodala, you start to change the conversation.
Well, and also, you give up, a future first rounder or something like that. And then they're a team that at the standpoint where they should be, like those future picks, those are the bullets they have to fire to, fill a hole at the deadline. And that's, that's what they should be looking to do every year. But if they have to do a very Doc Rivers thing and package those picks to move a contract, then all of a sudden that hamstrings them a little bit, just in that they can't, we could use a backup point guard this year. Let's go get, Jameer Nelson or something like that. Or the equivalent of the savvy veteran who can actually give you something next year. Not having the assets in place to go get that might be but that's minor detail stuff. So when the big picture is this is a great team barring injuries, should continue to be one.
Yeah, and I think they still have the room to improve and really understand the system. Something we see a lot in basketball in particular is that when you have a big kind of a more of a philosophy change than anything else with the way that they're seeing their offense and that they're getting for better shots, that having a full offseason knowing what you've been doing can be where you make that development. I think that their offense could be substantially better next year than it was this year.
Okay. I mean,
substantially better than second best in the league.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the good Bayesian response is no, probably not, just because it's already second best. So yeah. there's much more room in one direction than the other. But, I kind of going with what you're saying, maybe Harrison Barnes makes incremental improvements next year. Maybe Justin Holiday, a year under his system, he just gets all of Barbosa's minutes next year and is just, is kind of becomes that bench 3-and-D guy that's reliable. And that's just, that's an incremental improvement that can, there are those incremental improvements that can happen. Draymond, dirty kind of, not that I'm picking on him, but a dirty little secret is he's still not really that good a shooter. And maybe he improves he's slightly below league average 3-point shooter this year, despite, getting wide open shots. And maybe he becomes, a league average 3-point shooter, or he just gets a little bit better on those wide open shots. And all of a sudden that's an extra point or a game or so. And those are all like just little improvements that, you're right, could happen.
Yeah. It's a great point. And also now the family of Thomas Bayes gets to be excited that he got mentioned in a basketball podcast in 2015.
Woo. Oh, well, that's,
I mean, it's a right point. I was just thinking, as somebody with an econ degree, I'm like, oh man, that's a really good point. It's fun.
No, over at the Nylon Calculus, cheap plug, Bayesian reasoning is not king, but
yeah, of course, yeah, it's not like you're breaking new ground. It's just the nerd in me is like, oh yeah, yay.
That's just in general my sort of conservatism is like, anytime you're predicting like something historic, I'm like, probably not.
Yeah, well, and that's like when people this is something I think this is a good note to end on, is that there have been moments, but you see it with draft guys and you see it at other moments, where people are comparing an unknown, let's say a draft prospect, to a player, And they're not acknowledging that that player reached the maximum of their potential. Like, right. They're talking about, you know, oh, this guy, could, just this one's low or something, could be the next Kawhi Leonard.
No, here's so here's the example of this right now that is I think is come up is Tyus Jones and Mike Conley. It's like, yeah. Well, it's like, well, okay, first of all, do you remember how not good Mike Conley was? Do we have to call up Matt Moore's Twitter rant about when Mike Conley signed his first contract extension? And it was a, you know, a justified and now looks silly because Mike Conley's awesome. But like, all right, yes, he could be Mike Conley, but he's most likely going to be that Mike Conley, not the perennial all-star snub Mike Conley.
Yeah, I mean, there are some comparisons to Tyler Ennis and things like that, and, you know, that's the kind of situation that can happen. And the other way with that is when, and something we just talked about with Draymond Green, is when you move a guy from close to a perfect circumstance into an imperfect circumstance, or reversing that, then that really changes the way you think about them as well.
Right. Since we've talked about this, and can we close on one completely non-playoff thing?
Yes.
I want to take your temperature on this.
Okay.
You're the GM of a team that wins the NBA lottery.
Okay.
Decision maker du jour from Sacramento calls you up and says, hey, I see you got the number one pick. We have DeMarcus Cousins. Want to make a deal?
Yeah, my instinct is I would think about it and say no, but again, it would depend on the cap, something like that, because this is the year. Like, if it was a team that had cap space that they thought they could use, it would be a more firm no. But I love DeMarcus Cousins. I love DeMarcus Cousins, but I think Karl Towns could be the guy, too. And you get him for 4 years at a cheap value, and then you get him for longer. But I would definitely listen.
See, I think that's, like, if I find a shorter word than yes. I mean, okay, that's not true, because obviously you do, someone pointed this out, you do some due diligence and make sure that, you know, there's not like something undisclosed about DeMarcus Cousins that you're trying to get sold, you know, a lemon. But, you know, okay, Karl Towns could be.
Yeah, that's a great point. DeMarcus
Cousins is, you know, and, you know, as sure thing as a sure thing can be, nothing's a sure thing.
Isn't it the whole mystery box idea? Like, the mystery box could be anything. It could be a boat. I've always wanted a boat.
It's not quite that. I mean, but there is, you know, DeMarcus Cousins is, you know, an all-star and, you know, a going forward, a top two center in the league. Could Karl Anthony Towns become like the best big man in the league?
Yeah. Yeah. And also,
he could also become the, you know, the 102nd best big man in the league. Yeah. He could, and most likely he's probably going to be around the 15th or 20th, right?
And just, also, Cousins has defensive potential to become. I mean, he's already gotten a lot better, but I feel like he still has another couple jumps to make there.
Yeah.
And then you're starting to talk about him in a very different conversation.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think that. Yeah, but and that not to get go too down too deep down the, you know, the psychoanalyzing boogie wormhole, but, you know, I think that competitive team DeMarcus Cousins level of defensive effort looks different than what is going on here? Who's in charge this week? DeMarcus Cousins. And I'll just kind of leave it at that.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. And also, what's amazing about DeMarcus and why I'm such a huge fan of him is that as a center, he's the type of guy that works in a lot of different systems. You know, he's a guy who, because he's such a great offensive player, and he's getting better defensively, that he's one of those guys that you can do a lot of different things with. It's not a circumstance, let's say, Klay Thompson, or, you know, another player who's a very good player at a different position, who you wonder, like, oh, I wonder how they'd fit, I wonder how they do that. I mean, you have a little bit with another ball-dominant guy, but other than that, I mean, he works with a lot of guys.
He's not, I mean, he's not Al Jefferson, where, all right, to get the most out of Al Jefferson, okay, Al, that's your office, and don't go anywhere else. You know, Cousins is, you know, you can move him around, and he's very good in the block, but he's mobile, he can pass, he can handle the ball. You probably don't want him shooting a bunch, but still, there's like, let's put it this way, all the stuff people are talking that they would like to see Kevin Love do more in Cleveland. Like, you can have DeMarcus Cousins do that stuff, get him the ball in the elbow, use him in pick and roll, all that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously you're not going to, you know, turn him into a stretch five, cause that would be silly, but you know, but the stuff that Kevin Love isn't doing that people want to see him do is still stuff that Cousins could do. Right.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting way to think about it. I've also thought about the idea if he could get a little more range on his jumper, that you could put him with some different bigs. I mean, obviously, I think the dream with him is to put him with a guy like Serge Ibaka, just a guy. You want to put everybody with Serge Ibaka. But
yeah, exactly.
You could play him. Incidentally, the guy who I think Cousins would play really well with is Karl Towns. I think that you could do some fun stuff with using them as weak side shot blockers and bouncing around a little bit.
And Towns can step out on the floor a little bit, or yeah. he looks like that. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. Although,
I'm rooting for the Kings to get a top pick, particularly the number one pick, for a couple of reasons. But that is one of them, because also that would, I believe, would slide Miami's pick down. No, it wouldn't slide Miami's pick down. It would slide the Lakers' pick down. And so then if Sacramento and somebody jump the Lakers, then the pick goes to Philly.
Yeah, but no, I'm imagining like the Kings with the first overall pick, and then it's the draft room, and everyone says Towns in unison, and then Vivek says Kaminsky, and then there we go again.
Yeah, so. And then they take Gio Okafor, and that would be strangely intriguing, but...
Oh...
You just put one of them on one side of the block and put one on the other side, and it's kind of like I had this crazy idea years ago that the team should play two quarterbacks and just put them on opposite ends of the, like, behind the guards, and just snap it to one of the two of them and just get to confuse the crap out of the other team. It'd be like that, but worse.
But worse. It's like the Sam Seaborn, you should play a sumo wrestler as a goalie in hockey theory.
I actually do kind of agree with that as well. If you could skate.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking time. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Seth Partnow for taking the time to come on to preview the playoffs. You can read him at The Nylon Calculus, Fancy Stats, Washington Post, Hardwood Proxies and Basketball Network, B-Ball Breakdown, and you can listen to his Make or Miss podcast. You can also follow him. He's a great follow on Twitter at SethPartnow. I will have a second podcast coming out in the near future with Arturo Galletti. They were both recorded on Thursday, and they will both come out on Friday. And then also, if you are not listening to the Dunked On podcast that Nate Duncan started, and I've been helping him start that, you should really listen to it. It's an excellent idea. It's really well executed early on. I'm happy to be a part of it, and I think it will only grow in the future. If you want to reach out to me or to this podcast, you can send me an email at daniel.larue@realgm.com. You can also hit me up on Twitter at Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux. And also, I'd like to get the hashtag RealGMRadio, all one word, going. If you want to have questions, if I get them early enough, I can ask the guests. I don't really publish the guests ahead of time. Or it can be something that I do in the after section, because I really do like that. It's been something I was pleased to do with Nate's podcast, and it's been a lot of fun. So thank you so much for listening. Take care, and make it a great day.